Welcome to the Painting Lines Podcast, your one-stop shop for all things tennis. Join Eric and Aiden in their discussion for updates on news and pop culture, and from hot takes to betting, they've got you covered.
Ready?
Welcome back to Painting Lines. Last week, the clay court season officially kicked off with all the big names in Monte Carlo. And this week, we'll be running you through our key takeaways of what's been happening in the last few days. Aiden, I think I'm experiencing some deja vu, seeing some very familiar faces in this Barcelona final.
Yeah, 100%. I mean, same people, different result, though. So a new ATP 500 champion this week with Ruud. Massive result for him, obviously. His first, 10 titles were all 250s?
Yeah, this will be his first ATP 500. Like, were you pretty surprised or pretty shocked?
Yeah, I didn't realize that because I assumed he'd won at 500. He's been in multiple Grand Slam finals and multiple Masters 1000 finals. And obviously, there are a few people that are out. There's no Alcaraz. There's no Djokovic. But still, obviously, a big win here. And I'm happy for him that he got a bigger title here.
Yeah, I think it's a pretty cool tradition in Barcelona where the winner jumps into the pool after the final. It was awesome seeing Ruud just kind of with his smile, like awkwardly jump into the pool in his full tennis clothes. And then all the ball kids jump behind him. Even the tournament director jumps in too. Just a very good vibes type of scene.
Yeah, I know Alcaraz like made a dive last year, I think. But I don't know what Ruud did. I didn't see his
Ruud went with the jump. Like the jackhammer, like half cannonball where he jumped. Mm. Didn't grab both knees, just grabbed one knee and then went in.
Solid move.
Yeah, once again, two of those players that we had on the slightly regressed just back at it. Looks like last week was that catalyst. I mean, just the immediate impact of the clay.
They just seem like such clear clay court specialists now. Like there's no way you can argue that they're not significantly better on clay now.
Yeah. I wonder if it's a case where they've regressed on other surfaces. Like both have been in hard court Grand Slam finals.
Yeah.
So you're saying that since they are clay court specialists now, that they likely won't be in another hard court slam final?
Well, I mean, like I said last week, I think they have played essentially like top 20 players on hard court, but have played like top 5 players on clay. So a top 20 guy can make a Grand Slam final, like it's possible, but I think that's the level of likelihood they have of making another hard court Grand Slam final versus a top 5 guy's chance of making a Grand Slam final on clay. So for the French Open.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, that's fair to say. Speaking of the French Open, I feel like these two players, you know, I didn't really consider them that heavily, say 3 weeks ago. Now they're looking like favorites.
Yeah, 100%. And I mean, the thing about it that's crazy, though, is the fact that Ruud was the finalist last year. And just because of how kind of the season went after that, we kind of disregarded him coming into this. But you have to think, oh, that was only a year ago. He's literally the defending finalist. So we can't disregard him too much going into that.
Yeah, no, that is true. But speaking of, man, this final was night and day between last week's final. We saw a much more aggressive Casper Ruud. His serve was on, and he hit 19 winners and only 15 unforced errors. Whereas last week, we didn't really see him on the offense. He was mostly playing defense. As I mentioned, I felt like a lot of the sequence of points were, you know, cross-court rally, Steph taking a shot down the line, Casper getting it back, but, you know, in more of a defensive shot, and then Steph coming up to finish at the net with Casper 10 feet behind the baseline.
Yeah, I mean, I think in this final, like you said, Casper probably realized that, hey, I'm not going to win these finals by playing that style of very defensive, because Tsitsipas winning the final last week and making the final this week has clearly shown that he's playing at a very high level right now and that he's not just going to very easily beat himself. He needs a little bit of pressure put on him. And that's what Ruud did this week. And it seems like it was a successful strategy.
Yeah. Well, so how much do you think of it? How much do you think was Stefanos not playing as well as he did last week, or Ruud just playing exceptionally better than he did last week? Somewhere in the middle.
I think definitely somewhere in the middle. I think Ruud went for a different strategy this week, which I think because he was playing more aggressive, it changed how Tsitsipas was able to play. Mm-hmm. Because Tsitsipas, when he's playing as a more aggressive opponent, it's going to impact his ability to go for aggressive shots. Last week, it seemed like he was getting a lot of opportunities to go for aggressive shots and he was taking them. And this week, it seemed like he was going for a similar amount of aggressive shots, but wasn't getting as easy of setups almost.
In this final, he had 25 errors, Stefanos, compared to last week, only 12. So he played a much tighter game last week, which kind of makes me think that the reason why Rude won was because of Stefanos' lack of play this week.
Well, I think it's part of the aggressive nature that Casper was playing this week. Obviously, we talked about his 19 winners, but that stat doesn't include how many forced errors he created. And when you create a lot of forced errors, Tsitsipas is going to say, hey, when I get an opportunity, I'm going to go for more maybe. If the ball is somewhat in a playable position, I have to go for a lot because I'm not getting as many opportunities. Last week, he was getting so many opportunities that he could be like, I'm not going to go for too much on this. I don't have to end the point right here because Rude isn't going to finish the point against.
Yeah, no, that's a good point. It's also very interesting to see two players in the final last week and then same two this week, how much preparation they did, whether it was going to the film room and watching to see like, okay, here's what I did, here's what I didn't do, or just kind of like, hey, in Stefano's position, I beat the hell out of this guy last week, I'm going to do it again this week. And just kind of the lack of preparation because of the overconfidence.
I wouldn't say there was overconfidence. I'm sure they both prepared for each other, but I think Tsitsipas probably went in with the same sort of mindset of, okay, I'm going to try to play aggressive. I'm going to try to hit a lot of winners. And Rude said, I have to completely change my strategy. And when they were both playing more aggressive like they were this week, it ended up with Rude being on top.
Yeah, well, this will be an interesting clay court season with these two. Hopefully we can see a lot more of them.
100%.
Speaking of familiar faces, I haven't seen this guy, Nadal. You know who that is?
Yeah.
He's finally back on tour.
Yeah, but not necessarily how he wanted the tournament to go here.
Yeah, felt a little nostalgic watching him just because I got that feeling, kind of had that remnants of the big three era, like that generation of tennis, just kind of still holding on, still there. And yeah, he got it done against Caboli, made it like, didn't really pass on the torch quite yet.
Yeah, he still seems to have some level of capability, obviously, but almost seems like Nadal is kind of falling into a position of someone like a Murray or a Wawrinka, where they're not necessarily as dominant as they were, obviously, in their prime. They can still beat a lot of players because they have that kind of remnant of being such great players, but they're not going to necessarily compete at the highest stage. Obviously, this is a very early sort of statement. We've seen Nadal be back for one tournament on clay now, but that's what it looked like based on the two matches he played.
I mean, I think that's a fair assessment. You know, he goes in, gets it done against Caboli, who's, you know, not, he's a good player, but he's not up there like a Deminar. And you see him lose to Deminar. So he's kind of like, all right, he's got that ability, but he doesn't have enough to beat a top 15 player. And someone as athletic as Deminar too, who, it's kind of a winning ugly scenario that we had here with Deminar's drop shots. Like, he was kind of exploiting Nadal's lack of
mobility.
Yeah, mobility.
Yeah, well, I mean, Deminar can make the game very physical. And when he knows he's playing against an opponent that is coming off an injury and is a little bit older, even though Nadal is obviously known for having incredible mobility around the court, Deminar knows, hey, I'm going to exploit any weakness that I see because that's just how I'm going to win. And so that's what he went for.
Yeah, now he's one of those players that can say he's beaten Nadal on clay.
Yeah, that's true. Very rare group.
How about your reaction to Nadal leaving the stadium? Because this could very well have been his last match in Barcelona. And he got a huge standing ovation from the crowd. Like, they could kind of feel it. But he just kind of walked off as if it was like he'll be back. I don't know what you saw in that. If he was just kind of like, all right, I don't want to really soak this in just quite yet. I just kind of, because it is Barcelona, it's his home tournament.
Well, I also think it's to an extent he doesn't want to think about the fact that it may be the last time. And so he wants to try to focus on being like, okay, I'll be back here. I'm going to come back better. But it's tough to think about what's going through your mind in that position.
Yeah, I guess more of my question was, do you think people were overreacting by treating it as if it was his last Barcelona match?
No, I can understand their reaction because it's a very distinct possibility that it was. but the way he reacted was one of the few options that he had. Like, really, he can either do that or he can kind of take his time on the court and wave to the crowd. But also, there's a level of, like, all the time you're on the tour, the winner gets an interview after and the loser leaves the court. I think he's also kind of just respecting that sort of system.
Yeah, no, definitely. All right, let's move on to Rublev. Another early exit in this tournament. And I think that's pretty notable because I feel like first time, you know, it happens. Second time, you know, not everyone's great. But the third time in a row is getting kind of serious now.
Yeah, and he's actually also lost, what, 5 of his last 6 matches. But props to Nakashima, right? I mean, it seems like Rublev isn't playing at his highest level, but I think Nakashima obviously had to play well to beat him still.
Yeah, biggest win of his career. How about that racket smash? That was insane. At the end of the match, Rublev just completely, and I quote what the report or the caller of the match said, like, obliterated his racket.
Yeah, I think it's just that frustration from the streak he's in right now, just coming out and him being like, I got to take it out on something, and took it out of his racket there.
Yeah. All right, let's get on to what happened in Munich this past week. So we had the BMW Open, and this is probably my favorite storyline of the week. So Struff snags his first title in his home country. I think that is just awesome to see because the guy's 33 years old.
Yeah, I think it's always great to see a guy that, like, those storylines where the guy's kind of a little bit of a journeyman in the tour, and then he finds his success later on in his career. It's the same thing as when you see, I want to say there's this guy, Andre Ingram, who I think was 38 and played in the G League in the NBA for, like, his entire career, and then got called up at the end of the season 1 year. And it's like, even though it's not really consequential, it's still so cool to see him get that opportunity to play in the NBA, even if it's only for a couple of games.
Yeah, yeah. Making him like a Rudy thing.
It's just like achieving something that you've spent so much time on and that maybe you didn't think was ever going to happen.
Yeah, no, that's fair because many tennis players go their whole careers without winning a single title. And this could very well have been Struff here, but the dude played lights out, man. He didn't drop a single set the whole tournament.
Yeah, we'll get into the final a little bit later, but he came pretty close to dropping a set against Fritz there in that final.
Yeah, well, I have a theory here. So the weather in Munich was cold and damp, and I think the clay, it played a lot faster, which is what Struff actually excels on, faster surfaces. So I think it was just like the perfect conditions for him, which gave him a better chance in this tournament. Like, you saw all the players were wearing long sleeves. It was rainy. There was even hail on the court at some point.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think it's hard to say that Struff's best surface is not clay, right? Didn't he make, like, the Masters 1000 final in Madrid last year, and that's also clay?
Yes, but I think his playing style is more of a fast-paced, hard court style, the serve and volley, the aggressive serve and volley.
I see what you're saying.
I don't know. He doesn't hang back and play from the baseline on a grass or
I think, well, the thing about it is, even if his style kind of doesn't go with the classic clay court style, it does seem like he gets his best results on clay, right?
Yeah, that's actually an interesting point.
If someone plays really grindy on grass somehow, but they get great results on it, you'd still probably say they're a grass court specialist, even if their style isn't necessarily like super explosive, fast-paced shots.
Yeah, 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 that's fair to say. I wonder why he changes up his style then. Like, why would he not play as he does on a clay court on a faster court? It's kind of interesting.
Yeah, I don't know what that would be, but I'm just making the argument because it seems like he does have his best results on clay courts.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, his counterpart, Fritz, it was good to see him back in a final because I feel like he's kind of been struggling here lately.
100%. Yeah, he obviously lost in the first round last week, but it shows that he isn't giving up after losing that spot as a top American, and obviously this puts him back as the top American. Shelton got 1 week with that title, but I mean, obviously, that's still great for Shelton and really cool for him. But Fritz was like, nah, dude, I'm still the top American.
Yeah. And he's never won a clay court title. So this would have been pretty interesting. I want to hear your thoughts on him choosing to play the 250 over the 500.
Well, I think it's kind of what we talked about with Shelton and Tiafoe playing in Houston and then not playing in Monte Carlo. You'd think that he would be playing in Barcelona, given the fact that he's a top 15 player, mm-hmm. but I think to an extent he realizes like, I'm not really a fifth top 15 player on clay.
Yeah, no, I think it's a good move on his part too, especially because he has been struggling a bit. This would be a good confidence booster playing the lower tournament, but I feel like it's kind of a higher risk, high reward here, because if you choose to play in the 200 or the 250, if you lose early on, then that's just even worse for your confidence, because you're like, ah, I'm playing this lower tournament. I was supposed to at least make a run, may not win, but now I just lost again.
That's true, but I also think like the risk is really the same. It's not like you're going to get that many more points
mm-hmm.
for losing in the first round at 500 versus 250. So
right. Points aside though, confidence, a hit to your confidence.
I don't think it's that massive on the confidence aspect.
Mm-hmm. So another pretty interesting thing that happened in Munich this past week was Zverev getting upset by Christian Garin. This was the second time, and it was the exact same scenario 5 years ago, also in the semis in Munich, which I thought's pretty insane.
Yeah. I mean, I just think it's interesting because Garin is a guy where he kind of just seems almost like Struff a little bit. He's kind of like a tour sort of journeyman where he pops up every once in a while. Generally just seems like he wins a round, maybe two, but a player like him can have such a successful career being a pro, even without really being like, not even a household name, but not even being known by a lot of tennis fans.
Yeah, it's pretty funny when he played JJ Wolf down in Houston, they called it the Battle of the Quads.
That's yeah. quite the commentary.
I know. Dude, how about Runa and Struff? Runa got absolutely worked, and that was a very shocking result, in my opinion.
Yeah, well, I mean, we talked about how Struff is obviously was playing very well this tournament. And also, I think Runa, we know, has a little bit of a consistency issues. So while the fact that he got beaten so badly is shocking, I'm not super surprised he ended up losing.
Yeah, so he was a two-time champ here. So he was going for a third. And this match only lasted 44 minutes. That's how much.
That's crazy.
The slaughter. How about the fans? The fans watching a 44-minute match.
I mean, to an extent, it's almost a spectacle in itself that someone could lose that quickly.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. That's true.
20 minutes a set, essentially?
Yeah.
Wild.
And then another point, last one from Munich. FAA, first time winning three matches in a row since Montpellier in January.
Wow. That may be the shock of the week. FAA winning three matches. That's never something you expect. But looking at where he stands now in the rankings, he's currently two spots ahead of where Marozsán is. And I was thinking about that comparison, and I was like, I wonder which one you'd really rather see in a draw. Because obviously Marozsán is not as highly touted as FAA, because FAA was so highly ranked back in 2022. But Marozsán does have the reputation of creating those massive upsets. So it seems like they're honestly pretty comparable, because they don't have any consistency in their play level.
Yeah, that's pretty funny. Jeez. All right, let's jump into Bucharest. So we have Vucevic. He beats Navone for his first title since 2018.
Yeah, I mean, I didn't know he had a title even.
Yeah, I wonder if he took off his shirt and flexed it.
Yeah, probably. I mean, yeah. He's got to do something like that. When you got the muscles, you got to show them.
Exactly, the show muscles. But João Fonseca made it to the quarters. He's the young 17-year-old Brazilian. I feel like we're going to have to watch out for this kid here in the future. It's definitely going to be someone that he comes up a lot more.
Yeah, I mean, Rohan was really backing him a lot. So
yeah,
we got to be aware of him for sure.
Yeah. And Korda, the American, he made it to the round of 16, loses to Barrere.
Yeah, not a great result. But one of the funniest things I was looking at with Korda is he's actually almost past Tiafoe in the rankings, which is just so shocking, because based on how much people talk about these two guys, you would assume that Tiafoe is ranked like way higher.
Yeah.
Because nobody really, it seems like, talks about Korda at all. But right now, the top five Americans are obviously Fritz, Shelton, Paul, Tiafoe, and Korda. And they're all actually in the top 25, which is pretty impressive to have five people from the same country in the top 25, even if it is America, which is obviously massive.
Yeah, no, definitely. I think he's kind of the sleeper out of the group. But going back to what you said about having five Americans ranked in the top 25. That's amazing. That's great for American tennis. I almost want to ask the question, what is better, to have five in the top 25 or one in the top five? Like, what is better for the sport, to have someone like an American Carlos Alcaraz, who's just on top of the game, winning slams, someone that the kids could look up to, or five good players?
Five great players, I'd say, right? Top 25 is pretty spectacular.
Yes, I guess we hold a higher standard. We had Agassi, we had Sampras, we had McEnroe, you know, we had some dogs back in the day. Andy Roddick, can't believe I've slept on him.
You'd probably rather have a guy that is competing at the very top in terms of growth of the sport, because unless you're watching tennis, you're not really having knowledge of someone like Fritz in the general popular culture. Sheldon actually probably has more of that popular culture impact because of obviously his massive runs he's had, the two of them,
mm-hmm.
and how kind of explosive his game is. But yeah, I think you'd probably rather, for the growth of the sport among young people, have that top five in the world type of guy rather mm-hmm. than the five in the top 25.
That's what I'm thinking too. Two guys I want to talk about here real quick, Stan Wawrinka and Denis Shapovalov. So they were both in Bucharest and both early losses, second round. I don't really know what to expect from these guys anymore, because I feel like initially looking at a draw, seeing them, I'm like, oh, these are two good players. These are players that I want to watch. They're explosive. They're fun to, you know, catch a game. But what are they now?
With Wawrinka, this dude's old. That's just the fact of the matter. He's old. He's probably not going to make a bunch of massive runs in tournaments. With Shapovalov,
he's still a household name, you know?
He's a household name, but he's like Murray. You don't really expect Murray to make massive runs at tournaments either.
Right.
And then with Shapovalov, he's explosive. He's fun to watch. And he's a recognizable name because of his past. But it doesn't seem like he has the mental state to stay in really intense matches and make deep runs. Maybe we'll see him return to that level, but right now it seems like he's kind of a hit or miss.
Definitely hit or miss. And the reason I ask is because if I see Shapo playing, I'm tuning in no matter what. I'm watching because I know that he'll have he's got that beautiful one-handed, maybe not beautiful, but he's got the one-handed backhand that, you know, he could turn into a weapon when he does the jump. He's got a killer serve. He's a lefty. And I don't know, I just like watching him play, and I don't really expect a whole lot from him. Like, the reason I watch, it's not to root for him, to watch him win. It's to simply watch him play tennis and be entertained by his fantastic shots that are able to come out.
Yeah, I mean, he's a spectacle. That doesn't mean he's that great right. of a player.
Yeah, so I feel like we kind of hit on everything here this week. Want to jump into segments?
Yeah, sounds good. So what's new in tennis? What did you see this week?
I'm actually pretty excited. So we're going to see Alcaraz return to play in Madrid. He's got no rhythm on clay yet. He played clay earlier in the year in South America, but I'm not really too worried about this. This tournament's his backyard. He's won it twice already. What'll be pretty interesting is that he's coming in as the second seed because Djokovic isn't playing, and Sinner will be first seed. And so he has a bye. Alcaraz has a bye, and he'll play either Shevchenko or Rinderknech in the second round, which I feel like are two guys he should beat, but I feel like could give him a little trouble.
Yeah, we'll see how he looks when he gets back. It's tough to bet against him, given how well we know Alcaraz can play on clay.
Oh, definitely, definitely. What about you? What did you see this week?
My what's new was Djokovic withdrawing from Madrid. And what's actually interesting is that he's only played once of the last four times that Madrid was played. And I see this and I'm like, okay, well, that immediately generates more questions. Is he going to play in the Italian Open? What does this mean in the buildup to the French Open? But it kind of reminds me of this argument about this UFC fighter, Max Holloway. Max Holloway stopped fighting in sparring matches or hard sparring matches leading up to his fights because he said, I already know how to spar. I already know what I'm doing. Do I still need to do all these practice rounds before an actual fight where I'm just taking damage on my body and it doesn't really help me that much? So for Djokovic, at what point does he start to say, do I need to play in these quote unquote practice matches before I get to the quote unquote real matches? And when I say that, I mean the normal tournaments like the Masters 1000s, which are obviously big tournaments and they're important for a lot of people. versus the Grand Slams or the Olympics, which are like the real matches that he actually cares about right now.
Yeah, that is a very interesting point. I think for him, he's doing the right thing by kind of picking and choosing which tournaments he wants to play in because of his age. But I do think that it helps to just kind of get as many clay court reps in as you can, because clearly his picking and choosing this year hasn't really worked in his favor. He has no titles.
Yeah, I think it definitely is the type of situation where he should be playing in them, but it's also like you have to know how your body feels.
Yeah, no, I know.
But yeah, so what did you see for bet of the week this week, though?
Ooh, bet of the week. I like this. This one popped out to me. So I'm taking Navone plus 105 over Popgren. Navone is a newer guy to me. I haven't really been following him until this year. And he's made it to the finals in Bucharest last week. He made it to the semis in Morocco, lost against Berrettini. And Popgren's not really known to be a clay player. Granted, he had that big win against Rublev, a struggling Rublev, but I'm feeling pretty confident with Navone's odds here.
Yeah, I think it's a reasonable bet. I mean, definitely don't know as much about either of these guys. They're not the biggest of names, but I can see the justification for going for Navone here, especially with the positive odds.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and Popgren, he does have that big serve, but the clay just, you know, should take some speed off of it.
Yeah. Yeah, 100%.
Who are you taking this week?
I'm going with Nishioka plus 310 over FAA. I mean, like you mentioned, FAA got the three wins in a row. He's been playing a lot better recently, but I still don't have that much confidence in him not to lose in the first round. And plus 310 are pretty juicy odds for Nishioka. Nishioka is no slouch either. Like, he's a solid player. So I could see this match going either way. And with plus 310, I'm taking this every day.
I was going to say, I feel like anytime I see plus 310 against FAA, it's auto lock.
Yeah. No, it reminds me of, what was it, the US Open last year when I saw this post. It was like, oh, McDonald upsets FAA. And I was like, dude, that's not an upset right now.
Dude, match of the week. I saw an awesome match of the week this week. I saw Tsitsipas squeaking by Diego Acosta in a very tense three-setter.
Yeah, I watched this match too. Really, it was a very intense one.
I know. I'm going to walk you through it. So we had Acosta winning the first set. Steph won the second. And then Steph was serving for the match in the third, ended up dropping his serve, and it went to a tiebreaker. Now, this is where it gets really freaking tense, because he was behind 5-2, and he fought his way back to win 10-8. And when he won the match in the third set tiebreaker, he dropped to the floor like he had just won a Grand Slam final. Like, literally hands in his face, just pure exhaustion, laying on the floor. And you just love to see that type of emotion after a game, especially when it's not even a title either.
Yeah, I mean, he hit this ball, pulled a backhand wide to make it, I think it was at 4-2, and he lost that point. It went to 5-2. And I was like, this match is over. There's no way he comes back from this, because it was a bad miss. It was a shot that was like, definitely can get in your head. But somehow he was able to kind of settle back in and end up winning the match.
Right. How about your match of the week?
My match of the week was Struff beating Fritz in the Munich final. And one interesting thing about this match was, in a match that has two bigger guys that you kind of expect them to just hold their serves every single time and see maybe even two tie breaks, first two games, they come out and both break each other. Honestly, overall, there were a surprising amount of longer rallies, but really what stood out was how impressive Struff is in his ability to kind of just mix up power and go from a normal rally to just crushing a forehand and hitting it past Fritz from the baseline. And then Struff on his serve at 4-5 actually had three set points against him. He was serving at 15-40, saved two. Then Fritz got an ad. He saved that. And when he saved those points and ended up winning that game, it really seemed to just mentally break Fritz. Fritz went on to lose the next 8 points in a row to lose the set 7-5. And then Struff came out, jumped on him early and got a break in the second. And from there, it really felt like the match was over. It was interesting because Fritz kind of battled back into it a little bit at the end. He broke back, but in the end, Struff won the match 6-3. So it was an interesting match to watch, even though it wasn't necessarily the closest.
Yeah, the Struff waffle, baby. you're right. He went full Terminator mode, too. Those were insane hits from the baseline when he just needed to turn it on.
All right, and that's the show. If you're not already subscribed, go ahead and hit that subscribe button. You can find us on Instagram, TikTok, YouTube at Painting Lines Podcast. Feel free to shoot us a DM or email us any questions or thoughts at paintinglinespodcast@gmail.com.